Steve. I'm a recovering addict. And I would like to thank the convention committee for asking me to do this. Thank you. I guess I need to say I have a lot to learn, and Narcotics Anonymous has shown me a great deal. I'm going to share a few things about the steps, because I was one of those people who I didn't come here to just get clean. I was not content. I was not happy just being clean. I needed to do something to change. Because I came here, I was in a lot of pain. And I wanted to stop the pain. And, you know, I had a lot of good sponsorship once I became willing. And so when I say the word my sponsor, it's actually several different people. And a lot of what I learned just sitting in the meetings listening to what other recovering addicts had to say. And if you don't like what I have to say, remember I'm talking about me and not you. And if you, then again, if you really don't like what I have to say, maybe I am talking about you. you know, I got clean in the Hawaiian Islands, and there we would say something like Aloha Akakiahi Ekomomai, which means good morning and I welcome you into my heart. And I can say that with not so much fear today. And I think the most important thing I have gained out of Narcotics Anonymous and the recovery process is the ability to feel love and to feel my heart. And that is only a result of a lot of work. Nothing comes for free here. And I worked very hard to get to what I have today. And you know, some of it you may understand and some you may not. And you know what? That's okay. You know, this is just my program. But I wanted to first talk a little bit about my earlier life and what happened and what propelled me into addiction and then what got me out of it. I was born under the influence. My mother was a drug addict who practiced all during her pregnancy. And I went through a series, I was removed from her custody and went through a series of foster homes. And began to experience a lot of violence and sexual abuse, and I began to slip into a world all of my own to survive. And it was actually very traumatic. I had a lot of important messages very young that told me there was something wrong with me, and I believed that. You know, when I was 4 years old, I was molested by this woman, and it gave me the feeling afterwards. She did it several times, and it gave me this impression there was something really inadequate and wrong with me sexually. And then I was picked up like a football and kicked out of the door at four nighttime once, and I walked along. They told me to leave and never come back, and I walked a long ways before they came and got me. But it left a big impression on me. And on some level, I never returned to that family. I began to slip into this world of silence and being alone. After those few experiences, I remember I didn't talk a lot. I stopped talking. And I believe that silence is a big part of addiction. You know, we keep all of our feelings and who we are and what we're about and all our love inside. And it, in the end, it was like what I did to protect myself isolated me. And I had to learn how to let go of those protective skills. And it was a long process. I had to learn how to survive my feelings. And I found that, you know, recovery is not based on how I feel. It's based on what I do in spite of how I feel. And I had to learn new actions. And you know, I first came to Narcotics Anonymous in March of 1982 in Hawaii, and I had never heard of Narcotics Anonymous. I went, actually, where I was at was I was I was 29 years old. I lived on the north shore of Oahu, the capital island of Hawaii, and I had a gun barrel pressed against the roof of my mouth, and I was squeezing the trigger. And at the last minute, I shot the wall, and I asked whatever for help. And I got this immediate reply, "Go help yourself." Like, duh, you know. And it had never occurred to me to ask for help. I thought help was something that had a price tag attached to it. It was very humiliating. And actually today, it's exactly the opposite. It is a great sign of strength to be able to ask for help. And I pursued help. You know, I called all the local drug rehabs, and they all said, "We'll see you on Sunday or Monday," because this was a Friday. They were all closing their doors, and I was like, "I don't want to wait until Monday." And they said, "Too bad." And but this one place said, "We have come down and talk to us tomorrow, and do not use drugs." And so I came down and talked to these people, and in the end, they wouldn't take me because I didn't have insurance. They wouldn't take me into their rehab program, but they gave me three phone numbers. One was a place to work on a daily basis, and another was a place to live, to sleep, and the other was a phone number from a person from Narcotics Anonymous. And I had never heard of Narcotics Anonymous, and I just thought to myself, good drugs, yes, I'll call this number. And so I got downtown into Honolulu, and I stood there at this corner, and the place to sleep was closed, and the place to work was closed, and for no apparent reason, I called this number, and this guy told me, I didn't know what to say, you know, what do you say, and I just said, "I shoot dope, and I can't stop," and they gave me your number. And he just looked at me, and he looked at me through the phone, and he says, "Don't move, I'll be right there." And that was so important to me, because I could tell by the tone of his voice, he knew exactly what I was feeling, and that he was really going to be there. And sure enough, he came and picked me up. And that night I went to my first meeting, which was a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I did not stay clean. I went through it. What happened is the next 2 years, I went through about 8 drug rehabs. I relapsed about 20 times. I ended up in a psych unit at one point, and I was a sinking ship with all guns firing. And I was totally unwilling to do what they said here. I had attitude, and I had a great deal of hostility, and I was very aggressive. And I'm here to listen, don't talk to me. I'm here to observe. And I stayed, I finally got clean. I went through a rehab, and then I stopped doing everything they say here, you know. I went to meetings, and I hung around, and I was miserable. And I was about 2 years clean, and I moved from Hawaii to Southern California. And the day I was 2 years clean, this old-timer walked up to me, and he goes, "So, Stephen, how's your life now that you've been clean for a couple of years?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Oh, fine." Except the fact of the matter was I couldn't hold a job for more than a few months because I hated authority figures, and I took jobs I didn't really like. I had never worked the steps, never done any service. They call me Angry Steve, the walk-in resentment at meetings. I had my favorite words were "up yours" and "get out of my face." You want to know how I feel? You invade my privacy. And this guy looked at me and he said, "Stephen, you'll go far in this program." And I said, "Really? Why?" And he said, "Because you have so far to go." And at that point, I knew he was right, you know. And that was what happened is I said, "Why am I such an asshole?" And he goes, "You're not an asshole, Steve. You just act like one." And I said, "Well, why do I do that?" And he said, "To keep people away." And I said, "Well, why do I do that?" And he said, "So you don't get hurt." And I heard that. And I said, well, how do I change that? And he got this big smile on his face and he goes, man, I thought you'd never ask. That was the day my recovery actually began, because at that point I really experienced the willingness that you hear about in these meetings. I had used up every method of survival that I could possibly imagine, and nothing worked. Nothing worked. I was always unhappy. And so the idea of staying clean and just being unhappy and just existing and finding this mediocre, walking the edge of rage and fear and misery did not interest me. I didn't want to be here. So what happened is I said, well, how can we change this? And he said, it's very simple. You work the steps. And I'm like, I said, steps are for people with learning disabilities. He looked at me and said, yeah. I had a real problem receiving new information. I didn't like feeling ignorant. I didn't like anybody talking down to me. I didn't want anybody telling me what to do. And then I discovered that's not what sponsorship is about. We help each other. We guide each other. We share our experience, strength, and hope. And what happens is, if I'm willing to do some things that he had done, then I have a chance of experiencing some peace. And that's why I came here. And so I said, well, what are we going to do? And I, how are the steps going to help? And he said, the steps will help you change. And I said, exactly what do I have to change? And he said, you only have to change three things: how you think, your attitude, and your behavior. That's all. And I'm like, right. And I said, how exactly are the steps going to help me do that? And he said, it's very simple. You work step 1, 2, and 3, you get right with a God. You work 4, 5, 6, and 7, you get right with you. You work 8 and 9, you get right with others. You work 10, 11, and 12, and you keep right with yourself and your God and others. It's very simple. What it requires is a certain amount of willingness. And he, at that point, handed me a pad and some pens and a dictionary. And I just looked at that, and I went, what, are we in school or what? And he goes, yes, we are. It's about self-education. We are going to learn who you really are. And So I said, why do I have to write? You know, why can't I just tell you what's going on? And he said, it's very simple, Stephen. If you take all the information that's yakking in your head and you put it on paper, it's no longer in your head. And what that does is make room for new information. And I was a person in serious need of new information. And there was a very powerful value in me expressing to myself who I thought I was. There was some magic in the writing and in the relief that it gave me. It seemed to take some of the emotional pressure off of me, because I was always stressed every day. And I remember feeling a definite sense of relief when I finally started what we call the feelings journal. He wanted to hear how I felt, not what I thought, because my feelings were a little closer to who I really am. And I told my sponsor one day I wanted to get loaded, and, you know, I want to use drugs. And he goes, no, you don't want to use drugs. You want to change how you feel. And I understood that. It's like, we don't use drugs to get loaded anymore. We use drugs to change what's going on inside. And the truth of the matter is, it doesn't change anything outside. It's only a temporary relief. It postpones the inevitable. Sooner or later, we are going to have to learn healthier skills. If we want to stay clean, we need to find a healthier way to change how we feel. And so what happened is, he introduced me at that point to the first principle of the program, which is the principle of truth. He wanted to know how I felt every day. And I remember the first time he asked me how I felt. What happened is, he asked me how I felt, and suddenly a part of me zoomed back to where I was 7 years old. And I had a couple of experiences when I was 7 years old that left lasting impressions. I was watching cartoons one morning on TV, being a 7-year-old, laughing. And what happened is this guy came up to me, my father, and he slapped me and he said, "Stop being silly." And then I cried because he slapped me, and he slapped me again and said, "Stop being a crybaby. Men don't cry." And then the little rebel in me just said, "Wait a fucking minute." And I gave him a little belligerent look. And he slapped me again and said, you're bad, you're wrong, you're stupid. Go to your room. After all we've done for you, this is how you repay us." And I'll tell you, I got a whole set of messages at that point. It told me if I laugh, I'm going to be silly. If I cry, I'm going to be a crybaby. If I get angry, I'm going to be selfish. Another thing it told me is my feelings are bad. It also told me when I express myself, if I open my mouth, I'm going to get hurt. So I associate pain with my feelings. When they talk about character defects in here, I thought feelings were character defects. I thought if you had a feeling, you had a character defect. Because any time I had one, it dragged me and trampled anybody that was near me for days. And so here I am at this time, 30-something years old, and this guy asked me how I feel. And I looked at him and said, "Fine." And then he goes, "No, what are you feeling?" And I'd say, "Good." He goes, "No, what are you feeling?" And I'd say, "Okay." And then finally he goes, "Name a human emotion." And I go, "Okay, I'm happy." And I step back. And I waited for him to call me a name. And you know what? He didn't. He just goes, "Good. That's good to feel happy. It's good to enjoy recovery. That's why we came here. We did not come here to just survive. We came here to flourish, to really feel all the depths of our feelings. And it's about laughter." And I related totally. I didn't know how to laugh. You know, my laugh sounded like a cough. You know, and that was me laughing. I was usually laughing at somebody. It was not about humor. It was about making fun of somebody. And so I learned how to say how I felt very slowly. It was very awkward. It was very uncomfortable. And sometimes I lied. And then I was in the active addiction, because it was like, what happens is we got away from the drug factor. Yes, it is primary to not use drugs. But in the first step, when practicing the principle of truth, it was I am powerless over how I feel, and my denial of how I feel makes my life unmanageable. And I'll go into that in a little bit. So what happened is I started to tell my sponsor the truth about how I felt and who I was and what was going on. And I started to feel waves of panic and insecurity happen, because I was breaking a huge pattern of mine, which is about lying. The disease of addiction is about silence, or either that or lying. And what happened is, as I began to tell the truth, I was becoming vulnerable. See, the feelings that I had pushed down started to come up, and I started to feel panic. And then he introduced me into another spiritual principle of the program, which was the principle of faith. And it was in the second step that I began to learn how my disease tells me what to do. In the second step, when I feel my fear, it's like sitting in a fork in the road, and one road says, practice the art of creative diversion. That means I can change that feeling without using drugs, but I can use violence, I can use rage, I can use anger, I can use money, I can use sex, I can use all different kinds of ways to change my feelings if I'm not going to use drugs. And the other road says, practice the principle of faith. Feel the fear, tell the truth. I'm back in the first step. Tell the truth about how I'm feeling. And you know, one of the most amazing things about the principle of truth is when I acknowledge how I feel, it's not so much a problem anymore. It takes the pressure off. I tell the truth how I feel, and I feel the fear, practice faith, allow myself to move through the change, because that's what fear is. It's all about transition. I am in between point A and point B. And what happens is I have an option of doing something different instead of trying to change my feeling. Just sit and tell the truth and feel and shake and tremble and ask for help. And what happens is then I have the principle of truth and the principle of faith in my life. And what it does is we led into the third step where I had to learn how to ask for help. And there I learned the principle of humility. And I learned how to just feel humble instead of humiliated about why I was feeling my fear and instability. And what happened is, at that point, I was hearing all the what I call the spiritual, what they were talking about as spiritual principles, and I was hearing religious stuff. And I was afraid of being drawn into something religious. And my sponsor said, you do not have to believe in God here, Stephen. All you need to do is practice spiritual principles. And if you do, you learn a spiritual way of life. And then you come to a spiritual understanding all of your own. And what happened is I learned from truth and faith and humility, I learned the principle of courage. And the courage in the beginning was do not pick up no matter what. Just stay clean in the beginning. And then the real courage is to stop blaming others, because that's what I was always doing, and take a look at myself. And that led into the fourth step. And I worked the fourth step because I was tired of being and feeling the way I was. And I wrote out this inventory in an autobiography form, because back in those days, we didn't have the four-step guide. And I was just going to NA and I used no other program. And so we did an autobiography, and I went to my sponsor. And at first I was started to feel very nervous about sharing some of this information, because it involved some sensitive stuff. I was not used to talking openly about sexual abuse. And a lot of things happened while I was writing my personal history. I was remembering things. Things came to me. And it was very uncomfortable. And I went to my sponsor and I said, why do I have to tell you all this? And he looked at me and he said, because, Stephen, it's very difficult to spot self-deception by yourself. And so I told him everything. And then what happened is we learned that I have three major patterns in my life. I have abandonment issues, I have rejection issues, and I have betrayal issues. All of these things that happened to me, because I, you know, by the age of 15, I was in my fourth family. All these people coming and going, and all this conflicting information they're giving me about how I am supposed to be, and who I am, and what I'm about. And it was, I'll tell you, it was 99% negative. I hated who I was. I was full of shame. I was ashamed of how, when I had a feeling, I thought it was bad. And I was a very deep emotional person. All of us are. And you know, there's a law in life. If feelings don't come up and out, they go down and in. And then they come out, all right, sideways, down the street on some innocent bystander. And I had to learn how to let my feelings out. And the problem was, I wasn't. You know, I was afraid of you abandon, rejection, betray me, so I believed it was much better to give a resentment than to receive one. So I reject and abandon and betray you first. Why wait for it to happen? I knew it was only a matter of time you would do it, so it's, you know, up yours now. And, you know, save the pain. I'm not into it. So what happened is I decided I don't want to do that. And I found that my number one character defect is I am not true to myself. What happens is my feelings come up and I push them back down and then blame you for it. I'll give you an example of my addiction process. I woke up in recovery one morning and I was feeling very sad, very vulnerable, and kind of insecure. And where I come from, you do not tell anybody when you're feeling that kind of stuff. And so this guy walks up to me and says, so Stephen, how you doing today? And I looked at him and said, fine. Sad and lonely and insecure, came right here and went right back down. So he leaves, and now what happens is sadness is not sadness. I have pushed it down, and it becomes self-pity. I feel sorry for myself because I think nobody else will. I don't believe that I can reveal my sadness to anybody because I'm afraid you'll laugh and you'll walk away, and that would kill me inside. And so what happens is I'm now feeling self-pity. And then what happens is that begins to change, and then it turns into resentment. And then I get what's called the lip. My lip goes like this. And I start getting ugly. And I start looking around and I go, you know what? Up yours. you know what? It's your fault I can't get my feelings out. And it's what happens is I don't say that out loud. It's all in my head. All the voices in my brain that I have not resolved, all the messages I got as a kid start screaming and spinning their wheels. And you know what that is? Mental obsession. That is the first part of what the disease of addiction is about. My sponsor defined the disease of addiction is a mental obsession with a physical compulsion. And once we start, we cannot stop. So you better not start. And what happens is people like us have such deep emotional content that it takes tremendous effort to keep those feelings down. And that's what obsession is. That's what addiction is. It hurts to keep those feelings down. So that it's only a matter of time where we need to medicate it. So what happens is my head's spinning and I'm starting to badmouth people. I'm starting to tell people nasty things so they'll leave me alone. And what happens is if you really don't leave me alone, I know how to hurt anybody. I'm an expert at the art of attacking the emotional jugular, I call it. I can find your weak point. I can find your sensitive point in a second. It's all about shame. I can make you feel the shame that I feel inside about who I am. I can make you feel it. And so what happens is I start really hurting people, and then what? I'm all alone. I'm in pain. I'm by myself. I have no friends. And what's the only thing I can do? Medicate with some kind of drug, some kind of behavior, some kind of compulsive, unhealthy behavior to try to change that pain. The things we do to deal with our pain create more pain than the original pain. So what happens is, what is the solution to that? What I had to do was to back up to that first lie. That first lie that I told to my friend about who I am and how I feel is the launching platform for the disease of addiction. That lie triggers mental obsession, physical compulsion, and then miserable loneliness. And so what happened is I had to tell the truth, feel my fear, tell somebody how I'm really feeling, practice faith, trust that you're not going to laugh. I had to learn how to make healthy choices about what I was feeling too. Because I used to go to the wrong people and tell them how I was feeling. They'd say, so what? And you know, so in time I learned how to find healthier people to let them know how I feel and what was really going on. And then to not blame others for my emotional condition. So I found out that most of my character defects are a product of my unwillingness or inability to express who I am. If I don't express fear, it becomes paranoia and suspicion. Then it's a defect. Fear is not a defect. It's what I do with it that makes it what it is. Anger is not a defect. Anger is a reaction to pain. I need to validate that I am in pain, that I am angry about it, but to address whoever hurt me, not the wrong person, not walk down the street and hit some innocent bystander. Because if I don't express my pain, it becomes hostility and it becomes misplaced, and then it's a defect. If I don't express myself appropriately sexually, I develop lust issues, and then it's a defect. So I started to see that all my defects were about my unwillingness or inability to say who I really was. And those led to a whole bunch of other things that, you know, were all about negative behavior. I can give you lists of, you know, a zillion character defects, but it all comes back to the basic human emotions I have and what I do with them. So what happened is I started to feel my sadness and let my tears come. When I was angry at somebody, it was a big day for me. When somebody said something once to me that I found offensive, like I don't like racist comments. I don't like racism. So somebody said something racist once, and I went up to them and I said, you know what? When you say and do things like that, I get very uncomfortable. So when I'm around you, please don't do that. And you know what he said? Okay. That was a huge deal. Because what I would do is stuff it and then badmouth this person to everybody except him. And then the next person I went up to, he said something sexist. Like, I have a lot of friends, you know, of all different types of lifestyle and sexual preference. And I don't like it when people make derogatory remarks. So I went to him and I said something, you know, I said, hey, when you say and do things like that, I'm really uncomfortable. Would you please not do that? You know what he told me? Fuck you. And that was a very important lesson right there, because my tendency was, oh yeah, you know, I want to get in his face and I want to punch his lights out. I want to go for this guy. And then what happens is I have become what I don't like. I have become judgmental, critical, and I have become violent. And I'm not willing to go there. I have to learn how to respect that nobody, not everyone is going to think and feel the way I do. And I have to accept that they have their own life experience that brought their belief system to that point. And all I can do is attempt to understand, or at least just accept, that we are different. And you know what? I won't hang out with these people, but if they're in a meeting, you know, hopefully in time, maybe the spiritual principles will take over and their thoughts and their feelings about other people will change. I find that most people who are angry at others are usually angry at themselves. Who usually have, most of the times that I criticize people, I remember once I went to my sponsor and I said, I hate so-and-so and I have a resentment against so-and-so. And he goes, Stephen, that's not resentment. That's identification. Ooh, I did not like that. It's true. What happens is I identify with other people's emotional content and I can't stand seeing myself. The expression and the attitudes may be different, but what it is the emotions are the same. My pain is echoing with theirs. And so what happened is I began this process of taking responsibility for my own feelings. And what happened is, I'm going to tell you, something funny started to happen. My thinking started to change, my attitude started to change, and my behavior started to change. And I began, and the people I was associating with in recovery began to change. My feelings started to change, and I was changing. It was a miracle unfolding, and even I saw it. And my friends certainly saw it. Okay, I went into the eighth step. Somebody's got to tell me about time here. I get lost. I went into the eighth and ninth, and I did not want to go to anyone and tell anybody I was sorry about anything. It was like, I'm sorry I got caught. You know, that was in the beginning, that's what I thought. But in the end, what happened is my sponsor said, the word amend does not mean I'm sorry. It means to change. And what I am doing is changing how I communicate with people in the past. Because I was unable to say what my needs were, I took them without asking. I anticipate your rejection, so why wait? Just take. And so I took. And in the end, I need to make some kind of restitution for that. And yes, maybe some apologies are a part of it, but that's not what it's about. It means to change. And the real issue is the change is not about them. I cannot change them. Eighth and ninth step is for us. It is about letting go of the guilt and the shame. You know, guilt says I did something wrong. Shame says I am something wrong. And every issue that I leave unresolved creates like an emotional magnet. I will always be attracting to me people who will bring that issue back up until I resolve it. I will never be content until I am thorough with my own program. And so what happened is I made this eight-step list. I took it to my sponsor and he goes, which one's the worst one? And I said, oh, this guy, Adolf. This guy named Adolf raised me for 9 years. And when I think of him, my picture of his, there's him and in between us there is a fist. And that guy beat the shit out of me. I mean, bad. Back then, they call it discipline. Now they call it child abuse. I mean, when I was 7 years old, this guy jumped on my back and bit me and made animal sounds. And I went into another world. You know, they kept me in the cellar. You know, I didn't have my space with everybody lived upstairs. I lived in the cellar. I felt like an animal. And my last year of using, I got into artwork, drawing signatures on checks. And I found his checkbook when I had run out of cocaine. So I helped myself. And I talked to my sponsor and he goes, yes, you will pay him back, but that's not what this is about. This is about we need to find some peace between you and this person. And so what happened is I had to write a letter to him and just own my side of the street. And it meant, it's not I did this because you did that. It was, this is what happened, this is how I felt, and this is what I did. And this I will do no more. I had to let go of this, because I'll tell you something. I had never let this guy know how badly I felt he had hurt me. And what happened is, in this letter, I own just my side of the street and just what I had done, and let the power, a higher power of my own understanding, and my sponsor and my support group, let him know that I was willing to change my feelings about this guy. So what happened is, I wrote the letter, I put in the check, and then I called somebody in the family to find out where he is, and I found out he had died. And something very important happened to me when I got that information. I remember hanging up the phone and I went into another world. And it was like a dream. And I remember seeing my grandfather floating in the middle of nowhere as if I had never known him. And I saw this sad, lonely, vicious human being who somebody must have kicked the living shit out of when he was a kid. And he was doing to me what was done to him. And what happened is, I started to see that I was the victim of another victim. And what happened is, I started to feel sorry for him. I started to feel the principle of forgiveness. And what happened is, I forgave him and I felt a release. And then what happened when I forgave him, I forgave myself, because I saw an ugly fact. I had become just like him. All the anger and rage I felt towards him, I had kept inside of me, bottled up and medicated for all those years. And what happened is, I was venting it on all the wrong people. I was misplacing and hurting everybody because I was in pain. There's your seventh step. I hurt others because I'm in pain. And I did not like who I was at that moment. But what happened is, I let go and I felt movement inside of me and something changed. And what happened is, I felt a load lifted from me, and suddenly I felt a little more present, because that's what happens when we let go of the past. Our consciousness, our mind, is able to be in the moment and feel life, because in the present is where it's all at. It's where we can make choices, where we have a choice. And anything else left unresolved inhibits our ability to make a choice, a healthy one. What happened is, if I have anything left inside, I'll choose people that'll make me feel miserable until I go in and feel my own pain and let it out. So what happened is, I let go, and some important things happened. I suddenly saw that you are not my enemy, because on some level, the little boy inside of me that got beat up saw you all as my grandfather. He was the representation of a father figure. He was what I thought was my role model for life. And so I thought everybody, love was about pain. And you tell me you love me, then that means you want to hurt me. You know, that's the thinking I had. That doesn't necessarily mean it's the truth, but that's how I felt. And so what happened is, I saw that wasn't true. And I did some really important work right after that, because what happened is, once my grandfather got out of the way, he was like a number one resentment for a lot of years. Then all my sexual abuse stuff came up. And I'm going to tell you, there was a woman when I was 4, and when I was 7 or 8, a guy molested me, and he told me he would kill me if I ever whispered a word to it. And my reaction to that was, you know, I went home and I pulled out a steak knife and I stabbed everything in the house. That's all I could do, because I was terrified. I didn't know what to do. I was with these people who said, you know, so always told me, shut up, don't open your mouth, don't feel. And I stabbed everything in the house, and they sent me to a mental institution. I went through a lot of strangeness. And once I dealt with that grandfather issue, all that stuff started to present itself. And I started talking about it in meetings, and I've heard people tell me it's not an NA issue, it's not what we're about, and it's like, bullshit. It's my issue. And if I'm coming here, you're going to hear about it. There are two different people who don't like that kind of stuff. One is, they've never experienced it and they're ignorant and afraid of it. And the other one is people in denial of it. And what happened is, I went in and I found, you know, it happened later down the road when I was about 8 years clean. I started to fall apart. And And I didn't know why. I felt rage and pain that was I couldn't put a label on where it was coming from. And I found people in recovery who had been through, who knew my issues and pointed me out to other people. And what happened is I did some, what we call emotional release work. I went in and I went back to the point where I was a little boy and all these things happened. And I let the little kid part of me speak, because he had never been able to open his mouth. And what happened is it was a scream that went so loud and so far and so piercing that it bounced off the wall, and I sounded like it was somebody on the other side of the room screaming. And I let these feelings, I let some tears out, and then I let some rage out. And what I did is I had a big temper tantrum. I let the little kid in me have a fit. I was flinging snot and spit, and it was ugly. I made faces. I made sounds that I never thought I wanted to do. And you know what? At the end of it, it was over. It lasted a long time, a couple hours. And then it's been a lot of work since then, because I found out the obsession part of the disease of addiction was it kept all these voices talking really loud in my head to keep those feelings down. Now the feelings were gone, so there was no purpose for the thoughts. And that was the value of the 10th step. I began to daily journal and get that information out, because I don't need to protect myself from you anymore. You can't hurt me. Only how I receive what you say hurts me. It's not what people say or do, it's how I react. And if I don't like how I react, I go back to my first three steps, get my emotions in balance. 4, 5, 6, and 7, what's my thinking, what's my attitude, what's my behavior about? 4 and 5 shows me my thinking, 6 step shows me the attitudes, 7 step shows me the behaviors. What's my part in this first? I have to find my part and then address others. Otherwise, I'm giving other people my excess emotional baggage. So I learned how to take responsibility for that. And you know what? I started to make some real friends. And my life was changing more than I know how to say. And I got 3 minutes to wrap this up. So I'm going to tell you a couple of stories I had. In the 10th step, I learned about that this is an ongoing program. I got in a relationship and got out of one. And I got out of it very painfully. All my unresolved stuff comes up. And I went to my sponsor and I said, why am I so messed up? You know, I work the steps, I go to meetings, I'm in service, I work with newcomers, I have a sponsor. And he looked at me and he said, and I said, and I'm still miserable and I'm still in pain and I hate parts of myself. And he said, because, Stephen, we come to this program, we hang around a few years, we work a few steps, do a little service, work with some newcomers, have a sponsor, and then we develop low self-esteem and think we have arrived. You know, yes, this program works, but it's a process that takes time, and it requires looking at all aspects of ourselves. But there's no hurry. You know, if something's ready to come up, believe me, you'll know. It'll be right in your face. And then it's apply the principles, apply the communication skills. The biggest gift this program has given me is the ability to communicate who I am without fear, or in spite of fear. And so what happened is I learned that this is ongoing. In the 11th step, I learned how to listen with my heart instead of my head in meditation. I learned to pray for other people. I learned how to pray for myself, because I deserve good things. And in the 12th step, I learned about how to give, because that is why we are here. Addicts are the most intelligent, sensitive, powerfully talented human beings that walk the face of this earth. And our challenge is to learn how to embrace that and give. My sponsor said, what do you really want in life, Stephen? I said, I want love, understanding, and respect. He said, good. Now reach inside yourself, pull it out, and give it to somebody else. That's how you get it. And I have found that giving is the most unbelievably powerful gift that I have learned how to find. What's up is I have found that all my greatest weaknesses in life have become my greatest strengths. I'm not embarrassed about anything that I've done. I'm not going to repeat what I have done, but I am okay, you know, because everything has given me a valuable insight and awareness to help somebody else. And that's what this is about. We are here to help each other. And I have a couple of stories I'm going to tell real quick. One is, these are recovery stories. I got a job in recovery, and that was a big deal because I was unemployable my first year or so.
For the conclusion of this presentation, please turn the cassette over and depress the play button.
I did is I went, the only thing I liked to do when I was a year and a half clean was I loved to swim. And so what I did is I went down to the YMCA and I got certified as a WSI. I became a water safety instructor. I taught lifeguards. I taught swimming. I taught, you know, I was doing something I liked. Didn't pay anything, but I was happy. And that was a big deal. So what happened is I was running this pool in Hawaii, in Temple Valley, and there was this girl who cleaned the pools. And one day she came to my little cubbyhole office where I was feeling very important, and she began to yell at me with a mouth like this, this far from the back of my head, about things that had nothing to do with me. And in the old days, you know, it's like there's nothing worse than giving an addict justified anger. You know, so it was like my head started to get big and loud, and I turned around, and it was like for all the times anybody had ever said anything abusive to me and I never let them know, I was going to let her have it all. And so I turned around and I got in her face and I look, and she's going, and I'm like, is this where I hit her? And it's like, no, I don't hit women. I don't go for that. And so my head says, tell her to go fuck herself, man. It ain't my business. And so I got in her face. I looked her dead in the eye and I said, you're really upset, aren't you? And she went, well, yeah. And I said, you're really angry. And she goes, yeah. And I said, somebody hurt you. And she goes, yeah. And I said, it wasn't me, was it? And she goes, no. And I said, well, look, if somebody has hurt you, you don't have to yell at me. You come to me and talk to me and I'll listen, because I know what it's like to be in pain. And she looked at me and I got chills. I looked behind me to see who said that. And you know what? You know, she's a regular person. She's not an addict, but she became my friend. And that is one of the gifts of this program. I have found this place of, it's like I call it unexplained acts of kindness. It's my true nature. The thing about my higher power that I have found is my higher power is not out there trying to get in. It is in here trying to get out. It is about opening my mind and opening my heart and reaching past your mind and heart and touch that spirit in you. And when that happens, unconditional love is experienced, and we heal the wounds and suddenly understand why we are here. And that's what this is about. Give me chills. Sit down. The last story I'm going to tell you is a true story. I was on the north shore of Oahu feeling absolute insanity one day. Because I had never, I was about, shortly after that time, I was about a year or so clean, and I was crazy. I would have days where I wake up and I call it my black moods. I would have two moods of the day. One was homicidal and the other was suicidal. And there was no changing it. In the old days, I used to jump in the car, turn the music up full blast, smoke hash buds, drink cold beers, and shoot speedballs. Change any mood I was in. Now here I am a year or so clean, and because I've done nothing to change what's going on in me, I feel the same mood. So what happens is I jump in the car and I'm heading up to the North Shore, because at that time my higher power was the ocean. The acronym for God stands for Great Outdoors. For me, that was my God. I would go and sit on the beach and feel the power, the thump of these waves when they hit the beach, and it would shake the beach. And that power just soothed everything inside of me. I bonded with that, and that was my God. And so I was heading up there because I felt crazed. I wanted to die. I didn't want to deal with my feelings. So I jump in the car and I crank the music up full blast. I'm heading out the driveway. My eyes look in the ashtray for a little roach to smoke a little. And my head starts to romance. And that's what happens. If I start following the old patterns of how I used to medicate myself, it becomes instinctive to look for drugs. And my head romanced the smoke and the pot and all this. And so I turn the music louder. I pull out the driveway and I'm up the road. And there's this little kid hitchhiking, about 15. He jumps in the car because I pull over. And I figure he won't mind the loud music. And I'm going up the country. And the first thing he says is, let's smoke. And I go, oh, shit, no, I better not. And he goes, no, why? I said, well, If I smoke, I'll get thirsty. And he goes, fine, we'll go get some beers. And I said, well, then I want to smoke another joint. He goes, fine, I got a bag. And then I looked at him and I said, then I want more beers. And he goes, 12-pack, 12-pack. And I'm looking at him and I said, yeah, then we might as well go get a gram of coke, cut out some lines, and really get high. He goes, yeah. And then I said, then we'll go down to the drugstore, pick up a pack of fifths, we'll get an eight ball, and we start slamming it for a real rush. And he goes, no. And I said, yeah. And after that, we'll go by your house, check out your TV, your VCR, your bank account, your mother's bank account. We'll pick up another eighth. We'll fix that. Then we'll get a couple of papers of that Persian heroin floating around to smooth it all out. And his eyes got big. He looked at me and he goes, man, you better not smoke a joint. Better think it all the way through. You know, I was never out to get a buzz. You know, get serious. I want to get toasted, fried. And you know what? I don't have to do that anymore. You know what? There's still uncomfortable things that happen in my life, but my life is not good or bad. It's deep and it's rich. And sometimes it hurts and sometimes it's beyond description. And it's not what I go through today, it's how I go through it. The spiritual principles add an element of grace to the whole growth process. And that's what I've found. And I am relatively very comfortable in my own skin. I have a partner today. Somebody was asking me about a year ago, they said, where's your other half, Stephen? And I said, I'm not looking for another half. I want to be a whole person and attract another whole person. And I'm very lucky. I have found another whole person. I never thought I'd be a family member. I've never been married, never been in love, never been any of that stuff. And now in about 4.5 months, I'm going to be a daddy. You know? My life has come around, and it's real scary sometimes. It's going to be a boy, we know. And so it's like an extension of me. And it's kind of scary but exciting at the same time. And these things are waiting for you. So if you are new, go to a lot of meetings, get in recovery, go to step studies to learn about the steps. You'll find people in recovery there. And be true to yourself. Thank you very much.